Welcome to Fire and Ice, a North Fork Storytellers evening recorded this past February at Wise Heart Springs Inn in Paonia. North Fork Storytellers is a chance for members of the community to gather together to tell and listen to stories that center around a specific theme. Tonight's theme is Fire and Ice. Here to introduce you to the storytellers is the evening's host, Brian Calvert.
Some say the world will end in fire. Some say in ice. From what I've tasted of desire, I hold with those who favor fire. But if it had to perish twice, I think I know enough of hate to say that for destruction, ice is also great and would suffice. Welcome to KVNF's North Fork Storytellers. We're here at Wise Heart Springs Inn. The theme of tonight's show, borrowed from Robert Frost, is Fire and Ice. And so I'll introduce our first storyteller. Julia Bowman is no longer harboring dreams of Olympic glory. She does, however, enjoy long skis in the sunlight, followed by a cup of hot cocoa. So, Julia, come on up.
It's really hard to overstate what a dorky Nordic skier I was in high school. Cross-country skiing was my life. I trained year-round, except for 2 weeks after junior nationals in the spring, where all of a sudden I had so much free time because I wasn't training all the time. And I was that person who, when someone sneezed at school, I would hand them a convenient little squirt of hand sanitizer to prevent getting sick, because you lose muscle mass twice as fast as you gain it. So it was really important that I didn't miss out on any training. I also thought that my favorite outfit of red, white, and blue spandex worn with Uggs and a puffy coat was appropriate for the grocery store and the coolest thing ever. And do you know who else thought I was really cool? My grandma. She thought I was the best Nordic skier in the whole world, and she would let me know. She was a dreamer. She really hoped that one day I would become a Catholic, and she also knew that one day I was going to the Olympics, and she was committed to staying alive long enough to see me do it. So if you ever want to know how to win any argument ever, become a fiery Irish grandma, pick a statement, any statement, and just end it with "so there." So, for example, my grandma would say, "Oh, honey, you had the best ski race ever. I just know you're going to the Olympics." And I would say, "No, grandma, I got 10th out of 11th at the community Christmas ski race. I'm not going to the Olympics." And she would say, "No, you won that race and you're going to the Olympics. So there." And there is just nothing that you can say back to that. So my grandma Lucine was my last living grandparent when I was 17. She had rheumatoid arthritis, so her hands were really gnarled. She lived in a convalescent home. So all we could really do together was play golf, the card game, and watch the History Channel about the moon landing conspiracy. But when my grandma was younger, she was really glamorous. She was engaged 5 times. And when she finally married my grandpa, they would stay up late drinking and smoking and playing cards with their friends. She was a World War II nurse and told me stories about sneaking out of the nursing school dormitories to go dancing late into the night or early into the morning, which I don't think I have ever snuck out of. I never snuck out of my house. And then she was also really adventurous. When she turned 80, she fulfilled a lifelong dream of hers to go to China. And I can tell you that there was no one more popular that day on the Great Wall than the day that my grandma hobbled up those cobbled steps to that first tower. But, you know, for a grandma who's used to playing cards and watching the History Channel, the trip to China was a big one, and it took a toll on her. So eventually my family decided to move her from L.A. to Idaho, where my family lived. But before we did that, my mom and I took her to this old Hollywood restaurant called the Brown Derby. It's a really like famous part of Hollywood, which I didn't know, and it's one of those places where it's really poorly lit. You like can't see your food while you're eating, and it's covered in leather and red velvet, and it serves food like oysters and lobsters and steak and Manhattans, and my grandma wanted all of it. And it was all my mom and I could do to convince her that, no, grandma, we did not need a dozen oysters for the table. But she convinced my mom to let her have one oyster. So she had her one oyster. And she was basically full after that, but she still wanted a steak. But that was really expensive. And my mom was like, no, Mom, you can't have a steak. It's too expensive. You're not going to eat it. But she insisted, so we decided that I would eat the steak because I would actually eat all of it, and then my grandma could just like have a slice of my steak. When she decided that she wanted to order a glass of wine, that was a bit problematic because she was on medications that wouldn't allow her to mix alcohol with the meds. So she and my mom just had this fight in front of the waitress back and forth about whether or not this little 82-year-old woman could order a glass of wine. And my mom eventually gave up, and my grandma ordered a Manhattan. Except that they made the Manhattan with sweet vermouth, not dry vermouth, and Grandma Lucine only drank Manhattans with dry vermouth, and so she didn't actually drink the Manhattan. But it was just, oh, and then after that, she spent the whole meal telling us about how much she hated her nursing home. She was convinced that the nurses were stealing things from her, but then at the end of the meal, she insisted on us buying her two extra pieces of cheesecake in addition to the one that she forced me to eat because I was too thin. To take home to the nursing home for her nurses, which we did, because by that time we were just so deflated. And she was too. The glimmers in her eyes when she walked into this old Hollywood restaurant where she and my grandpa used to go eat turned into more of like glistens of tears. You know, her eyes were so watery, and she had just sort of been crushed by this meal. And I have to say, my mom and I were too, and I was not particularly unhappy when I unbuckled her from her seatbelt in the car to drop her back off at the nursing home. I think it's pretty easy after somebody dies to think back on all of the ways that you could be a better daughter or a better granddaughter. After my grandma came up to Idaho, I didn't visit her as much as I should have, even though the nursing home was right on the way to school. And my family could have been a lot kinder to her as well, but caring for her was like caring for a toddler. She was insistent, and she was petulant. She had a really bad memory, but also worse hearing. She couldn't cut her food for herself. She couldn't dress herself. She couldn't put a seatbelt on. She was totally helpless. So a few days after Christmas, I went out for a cross-country ski, you know, training for the Olympics. But I did have a ski race coming up in Alaska that I was getting ready for. So I was doing a long, slow, classic distance day, and it was just like the most perfect day. Extra blue, 18 degrees, not a cloud in the sky. The snow was really fast. The willows next to the river I was skiing next to were covered in ice and just glistening in the sun, and it was just the most fabulous day. And I was really excited to go home because I had the house to myself. My dad was on a work trip, and my mom and my sister were in Boise for some school thing. So I was driving home, got back into cell phone service, and I had 4 voicemails, which was very exciting because no one ever called me. But it was from my mom, my dad, and my uncle. And that was when I knew, when I saw a voicemail was from my uncle, I knew something was wrong. And my grandma had had a stroke. And I was the only person in town, so I needed to hurry down down Valley to Blaine County Manor to be with her. So like any good granddaughter, I rushed down Valley. I stopped at the grocery store for a snack and a chocolate bar because I knew I would get hungry and needed some emotional support. And then I stopped at my house to change my clothes because I didn't want to be wearing wet clothes. And you know, you have to take care of yourself before you can care for others. So I eventually made it to the nursing home where my grandma was lying in her bed unresponsive, and she wasn't supposed to wake up. And so, you know how you talk to people in comas or something? You're just like, oh, hi, grandma. Yeah, I'm here. It's Julia. It's okay. I'm here. And I just sort of sat with her, and then she woke up, like as from a nap. It was very surprising. And then it was just the two of us there for 6 hours as my mom and sister were coming back from Boise and from their day. And so over those 6 hours, my grandma would go through these fits of pain and then these bouts of energy. And I don't know exactly why I wasn't able to help her, but when she would go through these fits of pain, I couldn't help her and give her any more medication. All I could do was just arrange the pillows around her to try to make her more comfortable as she just sort of cried out and whimpered and said it hurt so much. And all I could say was like, Grandma, I'm so sorry. I can't do anything to help you. I'm just so sorry. I can't do anything except be here. And then during her bursts of energy, she was determined to call everyone that she loved who was still alive. So I held the phone to her ear as she said goodbye to her sister, my great aunt Mona, who lived in Portland, Oregon. I helped translate the mumbles from her final goodbye to her brother, my great uncle John. I was there when she told my aunt Tweeter, her youngest daughter, that her husband, Uncle Doug, was her favorite son-in-law, which we all already knew because Uncle Doug is perfect. And I was there too when she told Uncle JL, who was her youngest son, who had already written his name on the back of all of the paintings of hers that he wanted, where the watch that was my grandpa's, that was meant for him, was stored. She had some advice for me too. She told me that I needed to wait or save myself until marriage, lest I be ruined like my cousins. And I just didn't have the heart to tell her on her deathbed that ship had already sailed. And, sorry, Grandma. And, you know, she stayed with it. She stayed awake long enough to say goodbye to my mom and my sister and to my cousin Taylor, who had been out of cell phone service and was her favorite grandchild. And she also stayed awake long enough to make sure that my mom procured her a prescription of methadone So none of us were really worried that she was suffering on those last final hours on her way out. And I wasn't, you know, I wasn't actually there when she took those last shuddering breaths before she died. I was home. I actually had an AP literature test coming up, and so I chose not to be there because of the test and also because I didn't want to, you know, see my grandma as an empty shell of what she had been and what I had seen her as. And that I wonder now, had I been there, if that 6 hours that we spent together would be a little bit sharper and those memories would be a little bit brighter. The emotions are really clear. I felt such a sense of helplessness and sadness, but also this genuine laughter because she really said some funny things as she was dying. But I also wonder if that means if her death would have a little bit more finality. You know, neither of us kept up our side of the bargain in terms of me making it to the Olympics, but I do love cross-country skiing still. And so sometimes when I'm skiing and it's just one of those beautiful, clear blue sky days where the world just seems so expansive and you're just this magical part of it moving through the snow, or on days like right at dusk when the snow is falling and those big fluffy flakes and the whole world is just so quiet and it's just you and it's just your skis and the sound of your breath. And at times like that, I just sort of look up and I just say to myself, or just say up to the sky, thanks, Grandma.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Fire and Ice, a North Fork Storytellers Evening held at Wise Heart Springs Inn, recorded this past February and hosted by Brian Calvert.
I'm going to tell a story next, so I'm going to let Allie introduce me. I wrote this introduction just for you, Allie.
Thank you. I always wanted to do this. Okay, let's see. Brian Calvert is the managing editor of High Country News, who wisecracks when he's nervous in public.
When I was born, my dad was 23 years old, and I was 3 years old by the time he was divorced from my mom. So the relationship that I have with my dad is not necessarily like a father-son relationship. It's more like buddies. You know, I went through a period where he was my hero. I was born in Wyoming. If you know that many people from Wyoming, you know that they can't help but tell you that they're from Wyoming at least once a month. I'm one of those. My dad was a kind of a cattle guy and a rodeo guy, and when I was a little kid, I wanted to be just like him. The only option available for a little kid in a rodeo, as you may know from living here, is Mutton Buster. Those are the little kids that are sort of the comic relief of the rodeo when they ride sheep. You know, you just put a little kid on a sheep with their little kung fu grip and, like, let the sheep go. And, you know, you just try to stay on the sheep as long as you can, basically. So I grew up as a little Mutton Buster, wanting to be like my dad. I liked big, shiny belt buckles like he had. And sometimes he would make me perform Rhinestone Cowboy to guests. It would later become a karaoke staple of mine. So if I'm ever forced to karaoke, that's kind of my go-to Rhinestone Cowboy song. Eventually, I grew up. You know, my dad was not around a lot, but he was around. He just always just kind of stayed a buddy. I eventually had a job as a journalist in Cambodia for a while. In that period, my dad turned 50, got divorced from a woman I didn't even know he had married, a woman that he met on the internet. And after a short marriage, she cleared out his bank account, stole his car, and left him. And then he flew straight to Southeast Asia to visit me, and he was kind of a mess. And we had a little adventure in Vietnam. it's one of those, I think a lot of people maybe have this moment when you realize that you're maybe going to have to take care of your parent at some point. And this was one of those times where in a country like Vietnam, the traffic rules are a little bit different than they are here. It's pretty chaotic. Scooters are just zipping by all the time. And what you learn when you live in a place like that is that you actually just have to sort of treat it like a stream or a flow, and you just have to sort of enter the flow of traffic and sort of move at a constant pace so that all of the motorcycle drivers can weave around you. And so there were these moments with my dad, I mean, multiple times, where it's like, okay, Dad, you just have to slowly walk into traffic and say, okay, let's go. And he would just jump into traffic and boom, 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 and then he would make it to the other side. On that trip, we visited the Mekong River Delta area, and on a bus ride back from there, I convinced my dad to feed a skull bandit little chew pouch to a monkey that was hanging out in a cage, and the monkey went crazy. Those are the kind of things that like a son and his dad do together in my family. So, you know, eventually, you know, he left that trip, and I moved back to the States after a while abroad. My mother had passed away, and I wanted to spend more time in Wyoming with my family. And, you know, my dad and I decided that we would do a backpacking trip together to a place called Cirque of the Towers, which is a really famous, beautiful place in the Wind River Mountains, which is where I'm from, in Wyoming. And we decided that we were going to hike up a mountain called Warbonnet Peak, which would sort of, you know, Cirque of the Towers is a place where like hardcore rock climbers go to like climb these spires, and but you can go around the backside if it's just you and your dad. And so we camped at the base of the Cirque, and you know, had a campfire, and the next morning kind of put out the campfire, and then we walked up this mountain. And you know, that was a kind of time where I could see my dad getting a little bit older. He couldn't quite keep up with me, and he was sort of doing that Triumph of the Human Spirit thing where you're just from every rock to the next rock, you just sort of walk and then stop and catch your breath, and you walk and you catch your breath, and you walk and you catch your breath. But he made it to the top. And when we got back down to the bottom, there was a forest ranger waiting for us, pretty mad about this campfire that he had to put out, that we had sort of left. We sort of covered it up with rocks and just didn't do a very good job of putting out this campfire. So that trip kind of got us really excited to do another trip. So the next year, we went back into the mountains, and this time we were going to, we had like successfully climbed a, you know, a 12,000-foot peak or something, so we were going to go for the highest, no, not the highest, but the highest peak in the sort of area there. It's called Fremont Peak, and it's a peak that overlooks the town where I grew up. And so we set off one day and got kind of caught in the rain and ended up taking shelter in one of those forest circles that Douglas firs can make. There's sort of like, it's like a little fort almost, and you can get in there, and it was dry, and we made a fire, and we decided that was a good place to camp. And so next morning, we had another fire. I think my dad likes morning fires, because I don't normally do this, but he also carries like 2 hunting knives in his backpack for some reason. So he's like a really prepared guy in his backpack. But so we, you know, we put out, I mean, I swear we put this out. We put out our fire. We did a good job, I think, remembering like sort of the last time that we almost, you know, got in trouble. And tried to go up this mountain, and we didn't make it very far because eventually it got pretty snowy, and we ended up having to sort of like hide ourselves under some rocks and let the snow pass and the rain, and then just sort of like make our way back to camp. And when we made our way back, we came around the corner where we could see where we were camped, and there's this billowing smoke coming out of this patch of trees where we were. So it's like, oh my God. So one of the multiple times that my dad and I have had to run together in the woods. I think there was a bear involved in one of those. But anyway, so we had like ran, like sprinted to the place where we had been camped and tried to figure out what was going on. Well, the fires that we had set the night before and early that next morning had smoldered down into the duff and caught the roots of these trees on fire. And so they were just all day had just been like burning. And so it took us a couple of hours of sort of running back and forth to the nearest stream, digging out these roots, soaking the ground. It was just like a big, huge, muddy pit by the time we got done with it. But we managed, and the fire didn't spread. And, you know, it just kind of occurred to me that we weren't maybe very good at putting out fires. So we had a plan for the next year. We were going to try it again, you know, but I ended up moving a little bit farther away. And then I sort of did another stint abroad, and I never quite got back. And we've never quite really done another trip like that before. And then about the time I moved here, that was a few years ago, my dad had a run of bad luck. He got kicked out of the house that he bought with a woman that he met on the internet. And they had purchased this house together, but they didn't get married because apparently my dad had learned his lesson from the last time, except for he got kicked out of a house that he'd put a bunch of money into, and now there's like no way to do whatever. All his savings are in this house that this other person now lives in. So he got kicked out of the house. By then, he was working in the gas fields outside of Riverton, Wyoming, and that work was drying up, and he was working for a fly-by-night company that let him go, and so he lost his job. So he's out of a house, out of a job. And then his dog, which was the only thing that I'd seen him like really like keep for a really long time, actually got hit by a car and died. And it was just like this terrible run of luck for my dad. And he had me on the phone, and I've never heard this from him, but his voice broke in a way when he was asking me that he just needed me to come up and see him. And he was crying. I've like never seen my dad cry. He's like, yeah, he's a Bronco Buster and like a gas patch guy, and you know, he's just not like that. So I got very concerned. I went back and just kind of hung out with him for a little while, and I ended up loaning him some money. And then he kind of got over the hump a little bit and moved back to the hometown where he had grown up and met my mom. And you know, for a while he was just living in this apartment where he could just afford, because now he was pulling his Social Security, he could just afford to live in this place. But he'd been kicked out of the last place that he lived in a way where they kept all of his furniture. It was a very confusing story, but I think he just had a shady landlord and they stole all of his stuff. And he didn't really have any recourse, and for who knows what reason, actually, with my dad. So he just, he had no furniture. So he's living on this teeny tiny paycheck in a little mountain town in Wyoming that's pretty expensive. It has like one grocery store, and you know, like it's a little bit like Don's, and things are kind of expensive. And he was living on a blow-up mattress, and the rest of his furniture were like Tupperware bins and sort of like lawn chairs. Like he was living this way, and he went through that for like a while, like a 6-month period, or maybe almost like a year. And he would, you know, if he couldn't quite get the groceries that he needed to get, he would go down to the Best Western and pretend to be a guest so that he could get the continental breakfast, like the, you know, the like sausage and biscuits and gravy. And then he finally got a job. He got like this perfect job for him, which was being the sort of the intake guy at the thrift store, the local thrift store. So he would help them sort all the things and put the things out, and just kind of like just a job where you're just a runner at this store, but it was just enough hours per week that he could, like, he got over the hump, and yeah, he was just thrilled because he could walk to work, and he's in this town that he grew up in that he's always loved, and it's in the mountains, and he managed to keep that for like 6 months or something. And last summer he was on a dump run for work, and they had a trailer full of junk, and he was going to untie the straps from the trailer, and he did that thing where he just stepped off the edge of that 12-foot bay of a sort of garbage dump, and he fell. He fell 12 feet and landed on his back and thumped his head. And even now, he's got a couple of shattered discs, and he's got a ringing in his head that won't go away. And I don't really think we're going to be able to hike anymore. And then in November, we had our first fight. I'm 41 years old. I've never had a fight with my dad. Donald Trump was elected president. And I got a phone call after those results came in from my dad, and he was thrilled. he was thrilled, and I don't think he's not like a political junkie. My dad is kind of a romantic. He's kind of a sports guy. He loves the Chicago Cubs, for example. So maybe he was just high on the World Series win or something. You know, I'm named after a Chicago Bear, Brian Piccolo. You can watch Brian's or see Brian's song, the movie, if you want to know about that guy. So we had this fight. Like, he's telling me, "Oh boy, that was a close one, huh?" And I didn't think he was going to do it. And I was like, "Dad, we are so screwed. We're screwed." And he was like, "Well, no, what are you talking about? You're just, I know how you feel. That's exactly how I felt when Obama was elected." I'm like, "This is not the same thing." And I eventually, this sort of argument sort of built and built and built. And finally, I was screaming at my dad. I was screaming at my dad that he helped elect a flim-flam man that was going to F us in the A. But I... And thanks a lot, and that's gonna, and you know, and I'm just going crazy. And my dad is, and he's never had to say these words either, which is, "Brian, just stop yelling. Stop yelling." And so this, I mean, we, you know, if we finally got off the phone, I hung up on him, and we didn't talk for a couple of months, which is very unusual. And I didn't really know what to do, because every time I thought of my dad, he wasn't the person. Like, I couldn't reconcile, like, sort of my attitudes about the Trump supporters, as I understood them, with this dad that I know. And, you know, it just didn't make any sense. And I think a lot of people were maybe in that same position over the last few months of trying to figure out how to reconcile people they know with this sort of idea that they have. But finally, you know, we are patching things up now. We've talked a few times. I had to hang up on him one more time because we got into an argument about climate change, and he didn't know who to thank for all the snow that was coming into the valley. La Nina, El Nino, or Al Gore. And I just sort of try to explain to my dad this sort of complex chaos system that the weather is, and when you sort of have a warmer atmosphere that's going to do different things to the hydrological cycle, and no, he doesn't care. And he wanted to know why I got so upset. Why? I just think it's hilarious, Bub. He calls me Bub because Bubba Louie is the sidekick to Quick Draw McGraw, if anyone knows that cartoon. So anyway, I'm nicknamed Sidekick to my dad. So I'm named after a football player, but I'm Bub, or Bubba Louie, to be formal. Bub, I just think it's hilarious that you get so upset. And I was like, "Dad, well, I get upset because it's my job as a journalist to go out every single day and try to figure out what's going on so that I can bring that information to people. And when I get discredited by politicians who are in the pocket of corporations and the oil and gas industry who are intentionally misinforming people, that makes me upset." "Well, you don't think the Clinton Foundation is corrupt?" "Dad, I'm not talking about the Clinton Town." "Okay, I gotta go. I have to get off the phone." So that was our second attempt at trying to talk to each other after the Trump election, was this sort of just this sporting match. You know, it's like if the Wyoming Cowboys ever beat the Nebraska Cornhuskers at something, like the Cowboy fan gets to rib the Nebraska fan for a very long time until that title changes. And that's kind of, I think, what's happening with my dad. He's like, he feels like he's on a winning team. And I am worried that this has put a strain on our relationship that we're not going to be able to fix, and or it's going to be very difficult. And, you know, I think that I'm coming around to this idea where I have to be able to fix this, because not just because of my dad and I, and you know, I think it'll probably be fine, but because what's happening now in our political climate and in our media climate is this sort of this hatred and division, and I'm playing right into it with this person that I've gotten along with my whole life. And so I can only imagine what it's doing to other people. So what I, you know, started to try to think is that, you know, someone like my dad is not necessarily the problem. He's a part of the environment that allowed this problem to appear or manifest. And what I really think is that we need to find a way to stop getting separated by this sort of divisive hatred, because that's really its own kind of fire, and it's spreading. And it's spreading a lot faster if we're not trying to get it together. But I do think that it's a fire that's manageable right now. But if we're not careful, I think it's going to spread out of control. So Thank you.
You're listening to a North Fork Storytellers event recorded in February at Wiseheart Springs Inn in Paonia. The theme is fire and ice. The event's host, Brian Calvert, is going to introduce you to our next storyteller.
Our next storyteller is Michelle Amiot. She has been employed at nearly every nonprofit in town so far, so keep going. And currently at KVNF. And she hopes her mother never hears this story. So come on up, Michelle.
So tonight I really wanted to tell a story about spoiling cheese, but instead I'm going to tell a story about my mother. My mother is one of the oddest and most impressive people I've ever met. She became a female engineer at a time when the profession wasn't open to women. She's always picking up these weird crafting projects. I'd come home and she'd like have taken up leather working, or like she was making plaster casts of basset hounds or embossing greeting cards. She likes romance novels, Star Trek, and missing social cues. And so this all went pretty well when I was like a kid growing up in Ohio with my mom and my dad and my brother. And I didn't really notice her weirdness until I started this really terrible Catholic grade school. It was like populated by these like robotic progeny of Stepford wives. And I swear to God, everyone was blonde. There was some diversity though. There was this girl named Ashton and she had curly blonde hair. And then I was this really weird, chubby nerd who could not make it through gym class without getting hit in the face with something. And so my mom saw that, and she decided that the best way to help was to get really involved and bring all of her enthusiastic social awkwardness to the forefront of this school. So she started the Brownie Troop and was our Girl Scout leader and got me into Girl Scouts because that's the way to become popular. And she'd stay up all night sewing these elaborate Halloween costumes for us when everyone else in the school was like the same party store witch. And she would bring our dog dressed up as a cheerleader to the basketball games where I never scored a single point. And so I was pretty mortified. This all started to change a little bit. And the years before I went to middle school were really hard on my mom. Over the course of a couple of years, she lost both of her parents, her marriage, and her job. And this must have been an incredibly painful time for my mother. But I didn't really notice. I did notice that she didn't fight back so much, that she finally let me quit Girl Scouts after years of fighting about it, and that she just gave up when I would not wear the smock she'd made me for Colonial Day at school, and that she didn't really hug us anymore, and she just turned on the TV a lot. And if we really needed something from her, we could always ask, and she'd always come through. But I'd really started resenting having to ask. When I went to high school, it all got worse and angrier, I guess. She'd still somehow make it to every football game, taekwondo tournament, and wrestling match that my brother was in. But she never made it to a single one of my plays. I also never invited her. I was surrounded by these helicopter parents that were really, really involved in their kids' lives at this high school that was really academically and socially rigorous. And I really needed my mom. And she wasn't there. And I didn't really rebel. I guess my rebellion was just becoming president of everything. And I started hiding my report cards They had straight A's, but I just wanted to see if she'd notice. I moved to Chicago for college, and it didn't really help at all. I just kind of got more resentful every time my friend's parents would come to visit and she didn't. I eventually just moved further and further away until I came to Colorado. And I guess absence makes the heart grow fonder, or if you're Catholic, guiltier. So after feeling guilty about this for so long, about my like really icy relationship with my mother, I decided that last Christmas we were going to fix it. So I had this fabulous, elaborate plan. I'd invited my mom to spend Christmas with me in Chicago, where I was going to be house-sitting for a friend's sister. And all was good. I'd gone up there, and my mom had come up the day before Christmas. We got up there, and we talked about my elaborate itinerary for the trip. I had tickets to the Nutcracker, and we were going to see the new Star Trek movie. And museums and all sorts of fun things. So we hung out for like 2 hours, and I decided that was enough togetherness. And I told my mom I was going to go out for a couple of hours after dinner to meet a friend of mine from college. At about 2 a.m., I stumble off the train, throw up into a planter, and make my way back to the condo where my mom and I are staying. I'm noticing, I get to the gate and I'm like looking through my pockets and I'm noticing I can't find the keys, but some other guy's going into the condo at that same time and he like lets me in. And so I, you know, get up the stairs, knock on the door, and my mother wakes up and lets me in. She somehow does not say anything. And I don't know if I mentioned, my mother does not drink, nor has she ever seen me drink. But she lets me in without saying anything. And then we go to bed. I wake up the next day, more hungover than I've ever been, with the realization that I have lost the only set of keys to this condo, which meant that if my mother and I were to both leave at the same time, we had no way to get back in. This condo was suddenly very, very small. I was like, we can do this. It'll be fine. And I was like, I had these really expensive tickets to the Nutcracker that day. And I was like, okay, we're going to risk this. Like, I got in last night. It'll be fine. So we go to the Nutcracker. The Sugar Plum Fairy was spectacular. We come back, and we're waiting at the gate for some nice person to let us in. We're still waiting. My mom's getting tired, and it's really cold because it's, you know, Christmas in Chicago. And so I put her in the car with the heat on, and I stand outside the gate to this building, and I wait, and I pace, and I look innocent, and all this time, I'm mortified and so mad and so hungover while my mom is watching through the car window. Eventually, some nice woman with two kids and groceries in tow lets us in. I prop the door open until my mom can make it over from the car. And we go to this condo, and I decide we can never both leave at the same time ever again. And we still have like 3 days. I'm walking these dogs. I still have to walk these dogs, though. And so every time I walk the dogs or, like, leave for any reason, I have to tell my mom where I'm going and when I'm going to be back so she can be ready to let me in. One time I forgot my cell phone, and so I was, like, throwing pebbles at the window to try and get my mom's attention, which did not work. And no one was coming in the gate, and I had these dogs that were, like, pulling me in all directions. And eventually I had to beg some, like, stranger on the street to let me use his cell phone so I could call my mom to let me back in this building. And this whole time we're in this condo together, and it's, like, the living space is, like, a single room. And I swear, open floor plans were not made for these type of relationships. And my mom and I are there. Like, we haven't seen each other in a year, but we still can't find a single question to ask each other. And you can only talk about the weather for so long. And so we're just in this room resorting to watching like a Harry Potter marathon for 2 days. And I'm fuming. And my mom's last day in town, I can't stand it any longer. And I'm like, we have to leave this place. And so we decide to risk it and we go to the Museum of Science and Industry. And it was weird. When we got there, my mom told me that she couldn't make it around the museum without being in a wheelchair. And I was really shocked. I'd seen my mom limp at times and sometimes wince a little more and use a cane, but she'd always been really stoic about it and never talked about her health. And so we got her a wheelchair, and I spent the morning helping her get around these exhibits, feeling surprised and scared, and I hate to say it, a little resentful that even now I was taking care of her. And we tried to have a good time, but it got so tense after a couple of hours that towards the end we decided to see other exhibitions. But we met up and made it back to the condo, where I put my mother in the car and I stood in front of the gate and paced in front of the gate and looked innocent until some nice man led us into the building. My mom left town a couple of hours after that, and we didn't speak again for a couple of months. She called me in March to remind me to call my grandmother on her birthday. And I was really annoyed because I had called my grandmother. But she was like making this ridiculous small talk, and I was just trying to get off the phone. But then she said to me, she was like, "Michelle, I really did have a good time in Chicago, and I'm really sorry that you didn't." And then she said, "And I really do wish I knew you better, but I'm not going to apologize for raising a daughter that's independent enough not to need me."
Thanks, Michelle, president of everything.
If you're just tuning in, this is a North Fork Storytellers event hosted by Brian Calvert.
This will probably be obvious the next introduction I read, but I don't write these. These are given to me. So I'm going to welcome up here Beth Reboyne. Beth is made out of puppies and rainbows and cookie dough and a bit of residual Maui Wowie. She also hopes her mother never hears this story. Everyone give her a hand. Here she comes.
Hello. I think I'm going to stand so you can see my pretty face. So I went to college in Madison, Wisconsin, and I chose Madison because when I went to visit there for some sporting event or another in high school, I saw these stoner hippie kids sitting on a dock on one of the many lakes playing guitar, and I said, "That's what I want." And so I applied to Madison and got in and decided I was going to major in photography until I got to orientation and found out that Madison doesn't offer a photography program. And so my mother told people that I was majoring and going to concerts, but actually I was just kind of following what I thought was fun and interesting, and that turned out to be biology. And 4.5 years later, I had a degree in the biological aspects of conservation. And I graduated in the middle of winter, so I was looking for jobs on my archaic desktop computer dial-up while looking out this third floor window at one of those lakes that drew me to Madison, but now it was December and it was frozen over and gray and miserable in Madison, Wisconsin. So when I saw a job open in Hawaii, I thought, this might be for me. And it was a cool job. I got it. It was an internship. I shouldn't call it a job. I was a grunt for this program called the Biocomplexity Project, and that was a bunch of scientists trying to figure out why over 90% of the endemic birds on the island had gone extinct pretty much within my lifetime. And my job at the island was to trap and collect mosquitoes. And to do this, I would lug these big, heavy blocks of dry ice through transects all over like different elevations of the island. And the dry ice was to draw in the mosquitoes by mimicking these higher concentrations of CO2 in the air that draw mosquitoes in for a blood meal. So I thought I was doing pretty good. The interns and I, we were a goal-oriented bunch. And we had gotten through college and got to Hawaii, so we were doing good. But we weren't quite there. We really wanted to experience our Hawaii beach vacation party with the aid of Maui Waui. We couldn't score any to save our lives because we were a bunch of mainlander interns, so we weren't tourists and we weren't locals. We were just some lame-o haoles, as they called us, and we couldn't find any weed. So we had a lot of consultations while standing over this huge crater because we lived in Volcano National Park, which was pretty nice. It would have been nicer with Maui Waui, though. So we talked about it a lot, and we came up with this plan that the Bob Marley Tribute Festival was happening in Hilo just right before we had a bus scheduled to go up to Mauna Kea to the Space Observatory, which is like the premier space observatory in the world. And so the premier spot to be like a 24-year-old stoner. But so it became my task, since I was the only girl in this group of three boys and a girl. I was the innocent-looking one, so it was my job to score the weed. But the boys didn't know, because I never told them, that there were three other boys in my life growing up, my three older brothers, and they had named me the Worry Chicken. That was my nickname all through childhood. There's a song that went with it. I can sing it later, but so I was not too cool with being the person to score weed, but, you know, I was goal-oriented, and I had expectations of what this experience should be. So I go to Bob Marley Festival, and I'm walking around alone, all super nervous, and I approach this man because he's the least intimidating character there. He's wearing a big sombrero and a really gaudy Hawaiian shirt. And I ask him for weed, and he immediately smokes me up, which should be like, yeah! But actually, I'm getting more nervous because I'm a total paranoid stoner. And so he says, you know, if you wait here, I'll come back in an hour. I'll meet you right here. I'll have a bag for you. Problem solved. But in my head, I'm like, there's no way a man would wear such a stupid hat unless he was trying way too hard to fit in. He's a secret agent. So I'm wandering the streets of Hilo with just this racing heart and like weighing my options. And in the past, I've had encounters where weed kind of went awry for me. There was the time I was smoking in the arboretum, just chilling and watching the grass blow in the wind, which is to this day a favorite pastime. And I was just hanging out, and I heard these sirens getting closer, and I was like, they're on to me. And it was true, because soon this cop car comes rolling through the field, not on a path or anything. It's just bouncing along on a straight line to me, and the cop rolls down the window, and he's like, have you seen smoke or fire? Because we've had reports of smoke out here. And I didn't tell him that the smoke was me, but it was. And so instead I just like hid from the police for the rest of my life. And I was still, I was still hiding in Hilo. And, but so I did what I had to do. I knew I had to do this. I went to my friends and I said, sorry, dudes, I dropped the ball. And they're like, you dropped the ball, boner. And my last name is Raboyne, but actually, yeah, so my worry chicken nickname was killed on the spot, and I got this lovely new nickname. But the boys were pretty upset with me for dropping the ball, and I was upset with myself that we were headed up Mauna Kea totally dead sober, which is exactly what happened. Mauna Kea is a 14,000-foot peak, so like the biggest ones out there, but it's in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and it's a brand new mountain. It's still being built today. While I was on the island, I was seeing lava flows and like steam spewing out into the ocean, and so this is like a brand new island, but I wasn't really caring about that in the moment, driving up this huge slope. I was just getting kind of car sick on all the switchbacks on this gravel road that killed my kidneys. And we got to the top of Mauna Kea and got out of the van, and we're just like hit with this ice wind because it's at 14,000 feet. And it was like ice and cold up there, and it was sunset. And we were dead sober, and for a while, we were just like standing around, not knowing what to do with ourselves. But the first thing I said, I think, was, "This is so Star Wars," which is usually a line I save for when I'm really stoned. Then that line comes out, but because there were these big observatories, like all these outbuildings that were just crazy techno looking, and they were white. And they were domed, and inside the domes were these gigantic telescopes. And then it was just this barren landscape, and we were looking down on our whole lives for the past however many months, and all this biocomplexity that we had been studying was stuck down there. And I knew where there was a great or a humpback whale with her calf. I saw that bay. And I saw the bay where we try to catch waves. And I saw the forest, the fern forest, that I would have to climb over dead trees to put out my stupid dry ice. And like all this, all these parts of my life were visible from up there, as was like the vast Pacific Ocean. And we were just, you could feel that we were on an island, and we could feel that we were on top of this huge peak, so that it almost felt like we were popping up out of the atmosphere and could spin off out into space at any second. And then the sunset and the stars came out, and it just got wild to suddenly, not suddenly, but to have my mind opened up to just how infinite time and space was, and how these relationships were coming together and falling apart within my lifetime, but these eons of relationships between species and between our planet and way out there. I was tripping out, and I was totally sober. And it just goes to show, I guess, that the best times, the best experiences are when you let go of your expectations and you let go of the idea that there's one key to opening yourself up to the whole universe. Thanks.
I can't tell you how thankful we are to have another goal-oriented stoner in town. I just want to thank everyone that gets up here to tell stories, because I think it can be very difficult to be honest, even like one-on-one with people. So the amount of courage that it takes to come up and tell a true story to a bunch of people, even if they're your friends, but including strangers, I think is a really admirable thing for people to do. And I love having this thing because so many surprises come up and we get to know people even better. But other than that, let's thank Jeff Reynolds for all his technical support. And a big, 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 big round of applause for all the storytellers tonight.
You've been listening to an evening of North Fork Storytellers recorded this past February. Our next North Fork Storytellers event will be on August 16th at 6 p.m. at Delicious Orchards. The theme of the event is roots. If you have a story that fits the theme that you would like to share, email your story idea to Allie Lightfoot at allie@kvnf.org. The deadline for story submissions is August 11th.